Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow-up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
I feel like going somewhere different today. Where are we going today?
Well, today, Pete, we're moving forward in time, or back in time from where we are today, but the Suvla... I'm getting confused. The Suvla Bay landings of August 1915.
Oh, isn't Suvla Bay a wonderful... just a wonderful place. Sad if you have to fight and die there, but a wonderful place to visit, to explore, to see the battlefields, and to think about what went wrong, because bloody everything went wrong, but not for the Turks.
And a very different battlefield to, for example, Anzac.
Very different.
Very different.
Yeah. Great. Well, cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello, and welcome to another great edition of Pete and Gary's Military History. Now, this week, Pete.
Hello.
We are going to be talking about the August offensives in Suvla, 1915.
The first day, 6th, 7th of August.
Yeah, last week's podcast we talked about the Anzac operations of the 6th of August. This week we're moving to the north, I think, to talk about Suvla and the battles that were going on there. Not really connected, but you can explain for us, can't
I can.
You? And tell us the history, Pete.
And remember, we did one last year on the British diversion at Helles.
I can't remember yesterday.
No, that's true, year. Yeah. Now, so where are we? Well, most of the fighting had been taking place at Helles in May and June. They've been battering away. So the Anzac had just been held. A very brave defence, but it wasn't... there was no offensive activity really there. Now, the... after the third Battle of Krithia, they realised there was a stalemate at Helles. They still carried on attacking for quite a bit after that. But back in London, they had a meeting of the Dardanelles Committee, which is like the War Cabinet, it was called, in June, 7th and 17th of June. And there was a huge reinforcement sent. Now, can you remember which divisions they sent, Gary? Can you?
Well, I'm sure they were all hardened... experienced veterans, Pete, or would it be the 10th, 11th and 13th divisions, which were all new army divisions?
Which is their first... this is going to be their first time in battle. A lot of people think they went into battle for the first time at Loos, but that's not the case. It was at Gallipoli.
And in addition, there was the 53rd and 54th divisions, which were territorial army formations.
And not first-line territorial. They'd gone out before. This is second-line divisions, really.
Yeah, that all sounds as if it was just all thrown together.
Bit haphazard, would you have said?
I would have said that, but that's a long word.
Yeah, we can stick to short ones. So what do you think? What do you think informed their choice, or was there no informed choice?
Well, they depended almost exclusively on the availability of the troops and the question of transport capacity than on any real assessment of the overall strategic situation. And
so they weren't thinking about the Western Front.
Oh, they definitely weren't thinking about the needs of the Western Front.
Did they consider whether these divisions were ready for war? Because that's what comes to most people's mind. What new army divisions, second line territorial divisions, were they ready for it?
No, I mean, the training was woefully inadequate. The men were arguably still civilians in uniform rather than soldiers. Their regimental officers were all either older men recalled from retirement to the colours, or, as you described them, callow, young, inexperienced officers.
Right.
I'm not quite sure what the noise was, but yeah.
That was Fred. Fred, stop licking yourself. So they've got all these new divisions. Now, the trouble is, where to put the stalemate at, Ellis is almost hopeless, but Anzac, there's not much room. And then we discussed last week, Birdwood, Lieutenant General Sir William Birdwood, commanding the Anzac Corps, he planned a night attack bursting out to overwhelm the Turks on Hill Queue and Chinook Bear before, you know, swooping down to take to the neck and blah, blah, blah. We covered all that in last week's podcast, didn't we? I remember how thrilling you found it at the time.
I did. And I at this point, Pete, I just think I should say that the panting that people can hear is actually Fred.
Yes. Fred, it's not hot. I've no idea why he's panting.
There you go, listeners.
That was Fred. So where were they going to put these divisions? Well, they had, Hamilton and GHQ, they began to reconsider the possibility of landings at Suvla Bay. There's no space at Anzac, so they're considering Suvla. Now, it had been considered before. Now, why hadn't they landed down the 25th of April? It's got lovely beaches. Well, bespought yourself on those beaches.
Well, if you consider what the ultimate objectives were,
killed by here,
it's too far away, pure and simply.
Yeah. Now, the Royal Navy is brought into the planning process to get a simultaneous landing alongside the Anzac breakout operations. They're two separate operations. What does the Royal Navy offer? Because there's something new. And the Royal Navy are innovative by nature.
Yeah, I mean, they offer armoured motor lighters, which were ordered back in February 1915.
That Fisher, it was he, who intended them for use in the Baltic, which is a completely insane scheme that they had. What were they? Give us an idea what these armoured lighters are.
Well, they're sort of shallow draft craft, and it could carry about 500 soldiers. Now, they did represent a great advance from the towed strings of rowing boats that were used on the 25th of April.
They certainly do, don't they?
Again, we've spoken about them and their limitations. And they were colloquially known as beetles because they had like these two prongs at the front.
Their haircuts?
No, they had two prongs at the front, which were used for lowering the front of the boat down for a quick exit.
They're like assault landing craft.
Yeah. Oh, actually, that's a very good description, and that's what they would be called in the Second War.
Now, the Navy did something else as well, because they brought into planning, so they provide advice for the Army. Now, what is this advice?
Well, they try, I think, as best as they can, to survey the suitability of the beaches for landing. Now, they suspected there would be shoaling waters inside Suvla Bay.
Inside the bay. Now, yeah. We'll put a map up. You'll see that the bay is very well defined with two sort of promontories.
Now, the Army... recognizing,
they know far more.
Well,
about.
Recognizing that this is sound, practical advice, they choose to ignore it completely.
Absolutely, there won't be any shoals there. They said
no.
And now the Hamilton is going to form his new divisions that are going to land at Suvla into a new corps. This is going to be called Ninth Corps, Gary, or 1X.
I thought it was the X Corps.
And there was a lot of debate about who should command it. And the first suggestion, coming from Kitchener, was that the commander of the 10th Division, that's already on its way to the peninsula, and commanded by Lieutenant General Sir Brian Mahon. Now, there's a proper way of pronouncing that, which I'm not quite up with. Now, why is a Lieutenant General commanding a division? That's a major general's appointment. But the point was, That seems to be a solution. He is a lieutenant general. That's the level for corps command.
He's already on his way there as well.
He puts him forward. Now, something goes wrong. What goes wrong? And whose fault is it?
Well, it's Hamilton. Hamilton doesn't rate Mahon highly enough for a corps, believing he's reached his peak as a divisional commander.
Well, that may or may not be true. But what does he ask for, then?
Well...
Is it the moon?
Well, practically, because he boldly asked for either Lieutenant General Sir Julian Byng or Lieutenant General Sir Henry Rawlinson. Hang on a minute. What are they doing?
Oh, they're just down there holidays on the Western
Front.
Well,
both of them are attracting much admiration for their performance on the Western Front. And, you know, Kitchener naturally rejects it.
Right. Now, the trouble is, Kitchener also refuses to remove Mahon, from his divisional command of 10th Division. Why should he be sacked just so that they can bring in a junior officer?
So now you've got to have somebody senior to him in command.
Oh, dear. Well, that's probably a big choice, because we're not fighting a major world war, are we?
No. Well, you're not going to take anybody from the Western Front. So where does this lead, Pete? I mean, it's basic intransigence between them.
The pair of them, but it's Hamilton's fault, in my view, and the only one left, well, there's two left, but one of them really is old and fat. I'm not saying
anything. Was there a pregnant pause then?
Well, pregnant's word that goes. Anyway, the one they choose, and the only choice left, is Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Stopford. It's not the ideal method of choosing someone, is it really? It really isn't. This is for a complex operation of war, and it needs great leadership qualities. They need proven military command skills, and they need a sort of steely determination. Now, what was Stopford's background?
Well, what they got was a 61-year-old man who was...
Oh, it's old, isn't it? That's older than you, Gary.
It is older than me, and at the time it was considered... really old, frankly, and he was in semi-retirement as the Lieutenant of the Tower of London.
Oh, don't we know somebody?
We do. Somebody did something similar. Now, he's a career soldier, but his career had been of the sort that had not featured...
He was a staff officer.
Yeah, it's not featured commander troops in action.
Hang on, we wanted command skills.
We do want command skills, but what we're getting is somebody with expertise largely in the field of staff work. Which is valuable. You've made that point on a number
it's
of occasions.
It's not the skill set they wanted, though, is it?
It's not. Now,
Mahon would have been better.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Whatever his limitations, Mahon isn't a standout general, is he? He's sound enough. And later on, he does command in Salonika. So, anyway, the GHQ staff of the Middle East Expedition...
Were they French?
The Middle East.
Just move on. The GHQ staff, they produced the MEF. Initial plans, didn't they?
They produced the Suvla plans, and it's going to coincide with the Anzac offensive on the night of the 6th of August, 6th, 7th of August. So the original concept is for, what would you say it was? Using your extensive knowledge, you've just mentioned French, so...
It's a coup de main.
All that.
It's whereby
just, that's the, almost sexual when you say French.
Basically, the covering forces of the 11th Division would land on the night of the 6th of August on the beaches to the south of Nibrunusi Point.
That's the southern one of the two promontories that form Suvla Bay.
Yeah. Now, the task was to overwhelm the Turkish outposts, which are identified on the Lala Baba Hills and Hill 10, no idea where that is, before moving swiftly inland to seize the two ranges of Kırıç Tepe and Teki Tepe.
And they dominate the whole of the Suvla Bay area. One's at the back and one's on the left-hand side. The right's a load of foothills leading up to Anzac. You'll see this on the map. There's a complication that's been... In fact, we briefly mentioned it about Birdwood's plan. There were considered to be defence works and artillery positions, they're suspected from aerial photographs, on the southern slopes of Chocolate Hill and W Hills. They're the foothills below the Teki Tepe range. Birdwood wanted this taken out because they're a threat to his troops as they swoop out on the night march. And they're a threat. And he wants them eliminated by Stopford's 9th Corps. So they decide to attack them. They're on the southern face, if you can see it. So they're going to attack them from the northern face because then they'd be coming at them from behind, so to speak. The idea was they'd be attacked before dawn on the 7th of August. Now, think about what time of year it is. Before dawn means we're talking very early. It's sunny times.
Yes, yes.
To use a technical term.
Probably 3 o'clock in the morning latest.
Three-ish, yeah. So, one thing's certain. The crucial thing was the high ground, the Kirish Tepe and the Teke Tepe have to be seized as soon as possible. Thus allowing, and that lets the 10th Division, the 2nd Division of 9th Corps to land, to move inside as a formed body of men, to take any remaining objectives, and if necessary or possible, to help the Anzac Corps advance the Sari Bear Range. But this is very much a secondary objective. Now, everything then goes wrong. So let's sum up. That's the main intent is to establish a supply base to act as a solid, rock solid base for any future push across the peninsula after the success of the Anzac breakout. It's a secondary operation. Now, the plans are communicated to Stopford. They're not his plans, are they? And Stopford has a rather formidable chief of staff. Tell me a little bit about him. Just give me what's the two letters that sum up this man?
Well, he's Brigadier General Hamilton Reed, VC, and he's fresh from service on the Western Front.
So we've got Stopford, who's got very little command or battle experience, and who has been commanding in the Tower of London, and his chief of staff is a fire-eating VC who's just had practical experience on the Western Front.
Yeah. And now,
what do you think that means?
Well, what it meant was Stopford initially, he was favourable towards the plans, but it was soon eroded by the pessimistic Council of Reed. Now, yes, it was pessimistic, but he considered...
What does he say?
He considered that attacks on prepared positions were impossible without proper artillery support. Now, where do you think he might have learnt that?
Ooh, on the Western Front.
And through bitter experience.
So, what we're trying to say is, it's not a question of whether he's right or wrong, is it? It's whether his warnings are appropriate to the situation. So what questions are we asking? What do we really want to know?
Well, the first question is, were they really facing formidable trench works?
Or are they just sketched out trenches that have been seen from the air and there's not much there?
Now, does that mean, therefore, was speed far more important to catch the Turks before they could reinforce the sector?
So you either go slowly and surely to take these things, but you're then slow, or you go fast and try and get the crucial high ground before the Turks can get there.
Ooh. Now, while you're asking all these questions...
I am asking questions.
Doubts have multiplied at 9th Corps headquarters and a series of changes were introduced into the original GHQ plans.
Right, well, firstly, and this is a stroke of genius, they decide to land a brigade inside Suvla Bay to reduce the distance and time that would be taken marching around the northern boundary of the Salt Lake. We've not mentioned that before, but behind the inside the bay is a salt lake. Now, this is a bit unfortunate. Why is that unfortunate?
Well, what did the Navy warn about?
Oh, yeah, shoaling waters.
They warned about it, didn't they?
And now, what else is that? Just the reason that, in a sense, we haven't mentioned up to now. Why isn't the Salt Lake a big factor?
Well, because it was completely dry at the time. It had dried out during the long, hot summer of 1915. Has the dog introduced himself to you again, Pete? You're holding your nose and laughing.
God almighty.
Shall I carry on?
What? One of our friends said... Is Fred the Farty Dog all right? No, he's not all right. What are you grinning at, dog? He's grinning at me. How come you can't smell it?
I'm far away. Secondly, the capture of Chocolate Hills and W Hills was now considered problematic without howitzer support. So it could no longer be possible until after dawn.
Hang on, after dawn? The whole point was before dawn.
Yeah. Now, well, now they're changing it and they're saying it will now be after dawn.
I get the sense that Stopford's changes are removing purpose, urgency. What do you think?
Yeah, I think now the reference to the all-consuming urgency, 11th Division rapidly seizing the Kirich Tepe and Teke Tepe ranges, it's been expunged.
Oh!
And the 10th Division was no longer charged with any particular responsibility to push out and assist the attacks from Anzac.
Now, this is diluted. And it carries on with Stopford's subordinates. And this is, you've been in management, you know, if you don't direct subordinates, then they will follow your lead in the sense of if you're being lacking urgency, they'll even more lack urgency, won't they? It passes down. So what happens? One of the most important of those subordinates is who? Who?
Well, Major General Frederick Hammersley is in command of the 11th Division, and he was hamstrung by his fears and his orders, stating the capture of W Hill was only to be attempted if possible.
That's a clear abrogation of responsibility.
Absolutely.
Now, there's one thing that I haven't put in the notes because I thought I'd surprise you. What do you think marks out General Major? I've told you several times in Gallipoli, but you won't have remembered. What marks Hammersley out from his peers as a general?
Had some health issues.
Health issues, as he'd been in a loony bin.
I was trying to be polite, Pete, but yes, he'd had some health issues, hadn't he?
Yeah, the poor sod had... is that a good sign that you're going to be able to withstand fantastic pressure? I'm not sure it is. Anyway. How would you sum up the whole process of command and control within Ninth Corps?
Well, if I could use just one word, Pete, it would be disaster.
So the intent of the landings has been submerged by sort of conditional, well, just stupidities that left no one responsible for the attainment of the real objectives that had been defined by Hamilton. But I want to point out, Hamilton and his staff, they hadn't done it either. We said this about Napoleon controlling his subordinates at Waterloo. He bore some responsibility too. And here we have the same thing. He didn't control his subordinates.
Well, Stopford subsequently claims that he never even had a one-minute conversation with Hamilton prior to the Suvla landing.
Do you think this is good management skills?
Absolutely not.
You have to brief people. You have to look them in the eye and make sure they understand what you're talking about. Now, the result of all this, I'll sum up quickly, and you'll have to get your map out here. The 11th Division would land as follows. The 34th Brigade would land at A Beach on the northern side of the Suvla Bay. They'd capture Hill 10, which is just inland, and then send a battalion to secure the entire length of the Kirich Tepe Ridge. That's the one running along the whole northern side of Suvla Plain. Now, the 32nd Brigade, they'd land on B Beach, B and C Beaches, and they'd first capture the Lalababa Hills, just north of the beach, then move further north, join with the rest of 34th Brigade, march all the way round the dry Salt Lake, so this is all insanity, to attack Chocolate Hill from the rear. Yeah, always attack from the rear, if possible. They take in the largely imaginary Turkish defences from the rear. So that's the point. Now, the 3rd Brigade...
33rd.
No, what I mean, the 3rd Brigade of the... Sorry. I do apologise unreservedly for leading you to correct me. The 3rd Brigade of the division, the 33rd Brigade...
Oh, God.
would land to cover the right flank. They'd basically land and then swing round facing Anzac, providing covering the whole thing. And they'd also provide a divisional reserve as required. Now, one thing, what do you notice? Compare and contrast Anzac and Helles. Right. What do you notice about Suvla?
Well, it's open spaces. Anzac's tight. They're very closely together. They've got a bite onto the peninsula. Suvla, it's wide open. And actually, it's only weakly defended, despite Stopford's fears.
And more to the point, Bloody Reed's fears, Hamilton Reed. Now, Hamilton Reed, yes, think of it. Now, anyway, Reed VC. There's always two sides in a battle, isn't there?
At least.
Yes, you're probably thinking that horrendous battle when the Bane clans fought it out. Does the Turkish commandant do? Now, he's got an unimaginative parent, hasn't he?
Well, he's Major Wilhelm Wilmer.
Stupid Germans.
No, his plans are really simple. He's just with just two battalions of Bursa Gendarmerie and a single regular battalion. He didn't have sufficient men or resources to prepare a major fortification.
No continuous trench line. If you were there, you'd see you'd need divisions to do it. That it's huge, the whole area.
So what he does is he selects certain key points for defence of the coastal hills of Lalababa, Hill 10, and Karakol Dar.
Caracol Dar. Yeah, you can say that any way you like.
Oh, in that case, I'll say Caracol Dar.
Brilliant.
Thanks.
And this is a tripwire thing. This is the usual German defence thing that we had on the 25th of April. They're going to trip you up, hold you as long as possible while they sort out what's happening and move to shore up the points most in need. Where are the main lines of defence? Again, they're not lines so much as outposts.
No, but the forces are dug in as best as possible on Chocolate Hill, Green Hill, W Hill.
There is a Green Hill.
And further back along Kirich Tepe.
Right. But that doesn't sound... So that's only three battalions. So that's not going to stop a corps, is it?
No, but he was expecting that the Turkish reserves from the Buleir sector would be marching to the rescue.
And the Buleir sector is to the north, and that's the narrow bit where the peninsula is almost...
It's actually the narrowest part, isn't it?
Where we go across and we stop and look at that fort. Now, sorry, that's when we're on a battlefield tour. I do apologise, listeners. We do chat to each other occasionally. On the 6th of August, the 11th Division, that's the landing division, they leave Imbros. We've been there as well, Gary.
We have.
It's an islandy place.
It is an island.
It's called Gochada now, I think. At 1945 in the early evening of 6th of August, they're in 10 destroyers and 10 of the Beatles, the K-Lighters or whatever you want to call them. Now, you're going to be a young lad. It's always good to see you being a young lad, fresh-faced and innocent. You're going to be Midshipman Eric Bush from HMS Bacante.
The seven destroyers slipped their toes, which was the signal for all motor lighters to go full speed ahead for the beach, with picket boats following. The run-in took less than 10 minutes, but how different from Anzac. The landing was a complete surprise. There was no opposition and not a single casualty. A few rockets were fired, and one or two rifle shots rang out in the darkness, but that was all. Our motor lighter grounded rather far out, making it necessary for the men to wade in about 3 feet of water. They made a poor showing. No dash and a certain amount of talking. Indeed, a handful who obviously had had the wind up looked as if they were afraid to land. Petty Officer Main sang out and told them to get a move on. They went ashore after that.
Now, so the landings, the 32nd and 33rd Brigade...
Which was the third.
Which is the third brigade of the... They were landing on this long sandy... You remember that beach? It comes... So it stretches basically from Nimbrinetti Point, right the way round to Anzac, in a sense. It's a huge base, the north beach of Anzac. It's lovely, isn't it? Lovely sandy beaches, no opposition. The battalion sort them out, and the 33rd Brigade move off to dig a system of flanking defensives, while the members of the 32nd Brigade move forward. In particular, the 6th Yorkshires move to attack the Turkish positions on Little Lalababa. They're very imaginative names.
Mm.
Little Lalababa, Lalababa, and to clear the Nibrineski point. What is it? This is a very important part in the history of the British Army, in my view.
This would be the first attack made by a unit of Kitchener's new army, and they were very raw troops. Now, following up behind the 6th Yorkshires in the second wave was 2nd Lieutenant Edmund Priestman, who was a former Boy Scout master. Now, he couldn't help but be nervous as they advanced up Lalababa, and you're going to be 2nd Lieutenant Edmund Priestman, 6th Yorks and Lancasters.
Aye, we're nearing the introduction we've all had in our minds so long, the introduction to war as it is. As we push on through sweet, sickly-smelling scrub, now the darkness in front takes the form of a peaked hill, and we meet the first slopes of its flank. And then, to our straining ears, there comes a voice from the blackness on our right. Almost inaudible at first, swells up to a shrill, wordless whine, quavers for a moment, and then dies again into silence. Then again, this time it halts and inflects as though trying to frame some word, then almost as though it would sing a few quivering notes, it sinks down the scale into the night. And the shadows again. Whoa. Sends a shiver down your spine, doesn't it, Kai?
It does.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, although the Yorkshires get a fair number of casualties, they do capture both Lalababs, and the operation's on track at the moment. And soon, the first artillery batteries are coming short. This is very important to the command of 9th Corps. And you're going to be Bombardier George Dale of A Battery, 59th Brigade Royal Field Artillery. And that he's a character, and I like this chap.
In brilliant sun, the tug's bore squelches into sand, and we jump ashore with only wet feet.
Was he from the south?
And stare about. To the right, a sobering picture. Khaki forms with blood-stained bandages lie in rows on the beach, and bearers are coming over the dunes with another burden. A large Red Cross flag is being hoisted. On a sand dune 50 yards inland, a group of staff officers study a map and point. Now all becomes orders and bustle. Drivers are getting the horses ashore, ankle deep on the fine sand. We gunners know we've got a real job on our hands, getting guns and limbers with narrow iron-shod wheels up that steep beach of powdery sand. And the CO is calling for speed. Now for one of those brief, foolish incidents which somehow stick in the mind. Bombardier Bodkins, who never loses a chance to show himself, bustles up to me. Here, hold my rifle while I go in the water to help. What? A mere bombardier too? I start to redden and swell like a turkey cock. Hold your own, blooming something rifle, I shout. I'm coming in too. We exchange baleful stares, then lay our rifles above the beach and wade in together. One must stand on one's dignity sometimes. With horses pulling, gunners straining on drag ropes, the first gun is on the move, when inland someone slams a big door.
Bang!
Comes a queer whining note, increasing to a harsh shriek as our first round of shrapnel bursts out to sea with a vicious clang. Somebody's hitting a lighter. It's Dan Gray. Well, first casualty, the sanitary orderly. Shells whine over at irregular intervals. Many falling short or over, but we know they'll have the range soon.
But they go off and set up their gun positions. They're under fire now, but it's going well. How's it going with the landing of the 34th Brigade on A Beach, actually inside the Suvla Bay? I presume the Navy didn't know what they were talking about. I'm sure the Army was correct. Is that right?
No, it's a complete disaster. In fact, everything that could go wrong did go wrong for the hapless brigade. I mean, one of the lighters, K3, had aboard a company of the 11th Manchesters, a further company of 9th Lancashires, and the two headquarters companies. The K3 casts off from the Bulldog about a mile from shore, but as the destroyers had anchored some 1,000 yards to the south of their intended positions in the north of the bay,
is this a naval mistake?
The K lighters are heading straight for the area already identified by the Navy as being likely to shoal rapidly.
What happens?
Well, it's exactly as they feared. The K-lighters ran aground on sandbanks or reefs between 50 and 100 yards from the shore. So,
can you imagine sat in this lighter, the 500 of you, and you're a static target. You're well within rifle range because there's still people at this time upon Lalababa. You're open to shrapnel fire if they and the Turks are opening fire. Something's got to be done, Gary. What? And you're going to be Captain Geoffrey Mugans of the 11th Manchester. Oh, here you are.
No, I'm not.
Is it me?
It's you.
Oh, yeah, it is me. I'm glad it's me.
So am I.
The men were pushed and packed back in the stern to take the weight off the bows and so get off the obstruction. But this proved futile. Finally, it was decided for a few men to go over the end. with a rope attached to the lighter and take this to the shore, and that the remainder would get to shore as best they could, hanging onto the rope and pulling themselves along by it. The CO called for tall men, and I, being about 5'11",
yep,
step four.
Yeah, told you that was tall.
That is not tall.
That is tall.
Almost dwarf-like.
I told you that's tall before.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. How tall are you?
5'10".
Our second in command, Major Sillery, was going over first. He turned to me and said, "I advise you to take off all your equipment like me."
Wow.
I did so and jumped in after him. I went clean under and could not touch the bottom. However, I struck out, and in about 5 yards I found my depth. The CO of the 9th Lancashire Fusiliers, Colonel Wellstead, followed, and when we three got to the shore, Major Sillery, the Colonel and I hung onto the rope and kept it as taut as we could. So they've got the rope going from the lighter to the shore, and they're holding it so that the men can pull themselves along it. Now, back on the lighter, Colonel Bashy Wright, he keeps order and he's marshalling his men, trying to get them, that's from the 11th Manchester's, he's commanding. He's trying to get them down the gangway and into the sea. It's a pretty nerve-wracking business, and I'm sure it's you this time. You're going to be Sergeant William Taylor of the 11th Manchester's.
The majority of the men were under fire for the first time. It was a nerve-trying moment, and they received that kind of shock that stagnates action. And they simply lay down on the deck, undecided what to do. But a few words from Lieutenant Hart brought them to their senses, and then all made tracks for the sea. Personally, I groped my way through, my sole thought being to get away from the lighter, being under the impression that they were only firing at the lighter.
Now, on the beach, by this time, Captain Geoffrey Mergins, that's me, he'd been charged with collecting and sorting out all the companies as they come ashore. And they slowly piece themselves out. Actually, some are sent to help up on Lalababa and nearly get involved in a scrap with them. But this is what he says, and I'm going to be Mergins again. "There's a good deal of confusion and shouting." Sounds like the army. "Which, with the pretty hot fire we were under from Lalababa, made reorganisation difficult. At the same time, the old gun at Ghazi Baba started firing, and we saw the shells coming over us and bursting about 200 yards to our right front. The men, I thought, here were very good, lying still and trying to clean their rifles, which were soaked, of course, and nearly all choked with sand. Being unarmed, I picked up a rifle, but the bolt simply stuck fast, and I could not open it." And then I love the next bit. I gave it to a private who had lost his. Here, lad, have this.
He probably unstuck it, though, didn't he, being a private.
Oh, yeah, a more competent
individual. More competent, yeah.
Now, you're going to be Colonel Bashy Wright of the 11th Manchester. He's in charge.
"I had previously given my company commanders orders as to the order of march, objective, and also compass bearings. These latter were now of no use as we had been landed 2 miles south of where we should have been."
That's an over-exaggeration. I want to make that clear.
"We were all fearfully cold as it was a cool night. We were in thin khaki drill and soaked to the skin. The men were wonderfully cheerful and keen. I gave the company commanders a line to march on, more or less guessing the direction."
Now, this is an officer who copes with things are thrown in his path and he just gets on with it. He is an impressive officer. Do you think he can accurately judge the mood of his men?
Well, probably not at that moment, no.
Soaking wet, freezing cold.
But they never complain.
They would never complain.
Now, as they begin to ascend the foothills of Karakol Dar on the western end of the Kirich Tepe Ridge, they begin to encounter some serious opposition. And you're once more going to be Captain Mergins of
That's
the 11th
me.
Manchester's.
I don't know why you hesitated over it.
Because you spelt it wrong and put Mengans.
Instead of two or three sentry posts, we ran into several strongly held, well-entrenched pickets.
Pickets.
I hope I'm not going too far in saying that I shall always consider that the order not to load rifles had a very disheartening effect. Most rifles, it is true, were rendered useless by immersion in sea and sand. But I know it would have bucked our fellows considerably in the little trench episode if they could have taken a few pot shots at the retreating enemy and brought a few down. We were discovered then, and nothing was gained by silence. The whole thing was a beastly, nerve-wracking experience in the dark. He means that once shots have been fired, they knew they were there.
Yeah.
Now, so up on the ridge, what's that ridge like? You've done. You've been to the boot, which encompasses Kirikjeti. You've also been a little way up to the where was later Ninth Headquarters. Yeah. What's the ridge like? What describe to me Kirikjeti or Karakol Dagh? Karakol Dagh's at the end of Kirikjeti. What's it like? What's it like, Gary? What's it like?
Well, if I'm going to relate it to the boot, it's exceptionally hard going. You've got narrow, jagged ridges that's covered, and I mean literally covered in prickly scrub, and it falls away steeply on both sides. At times it's actually quite precipitous,
especially on the northern side.
I'm just stopping at the word precipitous.
I'm impressed by your grasp of the English language. It's as if it was your first language. Now the Turks, they're in a series of, well, some prepared and impromptu positions. Have they dug trenches up there?
No, you've got Sangers have piled up rocks.
Why haven't they dug trenches? Why?
Because of the ground, frankly.
It's rock.
It's rock. So you've got some natural breaks in the rock, and they used them, and they used them well, and you've got formations all around the narrow gullies.
Now, the Manchesters press forward. This battalion is really good, and the Turks fall back in stages to the next defensible point they can identify or find. Now, they're becoming a bit isolated because nobody else is coming with them. The Manchesters seem to be on their own. And this is what Colonel Bashy Wright says.
We managed to get on a bit further and were finally held up a few hundred yards in advance of a high point in the ridge, which was afterwards known as Jefferson's Post. The officers and men behaved most gallantly and made several desperate efforts to take the next hill without success. The forward slope of the hill was without cover and under a very heavy rifle and machine gun fire. Shrapnel was bursting over us from two guns on our right front, and the men were worn out with hard work and heat. They were fainting with thirst as they had given up any water they had in their water bottles to keep the machine gun going. At about noon, my leading companies were about halfway to the next hill, the benchmark, and could not move. Machine gun ammunition had run out, my second in command and two company commanders had been killed, and a third wounded, and we were suffering heavily. I was hit myself, and there were no signs of our being reinforced. Anxious as we were to take the benchmark, it was impossible, and there was nothing to do but hang on as best we could and hold the ground we had taken.
Wow.
Now, we've talked about, you know, how little water they had. And actually, he's talking about them not being able to drink it and using it to cool the machine gun.
Yeah. And we've talked, it's a constant theme. When we go there, we've got, the boot walk, which is to the left of this, but it's a 6-bottle walk. And they've got one water bottle and they've had to give it up. They must have been suffering agonies. Now, the Manchesters could do no more. They've done fantastically. I'm really impressed by them. But behind them, everybody, the three brigades of the 11th Division, they were hours behind schedule. And then worse confusion, because when at about 4:30 in the morning, the forward elements of 10th Division begin to arrive, it all goes wrong. It had been planned that they'd land in A Beach, that's the one inside the bay, and reinforce the 34th Brigade in the push along Kirikjeti. But the shoals, and it's impossible. There's some mines on one of the beaches. So they decide to land 31st Brigade and half of 30th Brigade of 10th Division on C Beach, that's next to B Beach, along at the other side of Nibranesi Point. Oh, no. And that weakens the force. That leaves the Manchesters on their own for ages. And anyway, bugger it. Let's just go. We've got, it's just so much confusion. The division, 30th Brigade, had already been detached because they were helping with the Anzac Corps left Hawk. So there were only two brigades of 10th Division on this. So where does that leave Lieutenant General Sir Brian Mahon? By the way, no, Lieutenant General. What's left of his brigade, of his division? Yes. It's a brigade, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's split into three, isn't it? And it's going to have devastating effect on command and control. All of the changes in the plan cause delays, and time's just ticking away. What does time wait for?
Oh,
no man.
Whoa, Did you invent that phrase? Anyway, it takes several hours before the Irish battalions of 10th Division can get themselves organised and get themselves up to reinforce the Manchesters. It's too late. What about the rest of 34th Brigade? That's the ones who'd landed with the Manchesters. Well, the 9th Lancashire Fusiliers eventually managed to get ashore. Funnily enough, the Northumberland Fusiliers, actually, they were stuck most of the day about 600 yards offshore. They never get ashore.
Now, but they send out patrols ahead of them, didn't they?
And the Lancashires, yeah.
And what do they find, Pete? They find the Salt Lake, and feeling out to their lesson flakes, they determine their position.
They're trying to find out where their salt dumps are. But it's all chaotic. And when dawn breaks, you're dead right, 3 o'clock. What a good judge of time you are. I'm impressed.
I'll get my coat.
Now, so they're confused. And by this time, Colonel Harry Welster has been lightly wounded. And Major Cyril Ibbotson, who's sort of there, he's interfered with by... who's he interfered with?
Well,
by?
He's briefed rather than interfered with in a rather brusque manner by Major Lionel Ashburner, who's the senior staff officer of the 34th Brigade. And you're going to be Major Cyril Ibbotson of the 9th Lancashire Fusiliers. What does he say, Pete?
Well, he doesn't say it. This is what Ashburner says to him. Look, just see that hill over there on the left? That is the hill we want, Hill 10. If you could take all the men you've got and carry that hill between those two trees on the horizon, we shall be all right. Otherwise, we shall probably be driven into the sea. And then this is what Ibbotson says. We started in three lines in extended order, the men going forward splendidly, led by their platoon commanders, in the most superb manner imaginable, with shells and bullets coming thicker and thicker, every man being eager to get the objective. There was a check just before we got to the foot of the hill. Then, in one mad rush, we carried the hill at the point of the bayonet. So they've got Hill 10, have they? Have they got Hill 10?
Well, actually, no, it's not Hill 10.
Hill 10 seems very difficult to spot.
The low hill was just a sand hill occupied by a small Turkish detachment, and the real Hill 10 was about 400 yards further north. We'll put a map up, Pete, and we still won't actually know where
well,
it is.
Well, Hill 10's a joke because it is only 10 metres or feet high. It's very difficult. A sand hill would be you could see why they come all across Suva, there's similar mistakes, similar confusion. But there's an Australian perspective that they're not, or New Zealand, that they're not fighting. Well, they are fighting, and it's an invisible enemy. And if you remember that at Anzac, just one company held off the Anzac Corps. At Hellas, just one battalion holds off the landings there. Here, there are three battalions holding off very inexperienced troops. It's the same story again. And I'm going to be, who am I going to be?
You're going to be Private G.A. Hanford of the 8th Duke of Wellington's Regiment.
In their retirement, the Turks had artfully concealed a whole army of snipers in 1,001 different places. What, you think that's accurate?
It was 1,000.
More like one. What an effect these pests had on our progress is best described in the casualties, which were mostly the victims of some fiendish snipers. Already we had lost the majority of our commissioned officers, to say nothing of a good few NCOs and men. Parties would go out, voluntary, in search of these fiends, but all to no good. But generally they would return with the majority of them missing, victims to the snipers, so they wouldn't return, is what he's saying. And this is the point. Snipers, there would be a few of them.
There would be, and the Turks are
using... And why do they aim at officers? Because they're in charge. Who's in charge when the officers are dead? The NCOs.
There is an argument they should go for the NCOs first, actually. But, you know, the Turks are using the ground well. They're using it to their advantage.
Now, it's not just snipers. The Turkish artillery, and we've seen two of the guns that are there. You know those two old guns back by Anafarta, little Anafarta, not big Anafarta, Gary. And you're going to be a Bombardier George Dale of the 59th Brigade, RFA.
As we wheel right from the beach, a shell thuds into the hillside above, and the drivers whip up their horses. Away they go, leaving Herbert and I alone, orphans of the storm. Oh. We grab hands and break into a trot, Faster, faster, I seem to hear my guardian angel say, as another shell lands short. Now we're in top gear with rifle, bandolier with 50 rounds, haversacks askew, water bottles and mess tins clanking, stumbling like stampeding cattle over salt bushes, puffing hard and muck sweat streaming. No, no, it wasn't funny, chums. Bang! Scream! Crack! Down now on our bellies, while pellets thud into the ground. I'm hitting the head. No, it's the darn rifle. Damn near that one. You all right, George? Yes. Are you Hubert? Up again and scuttle on. It's our first Gallipoli gallop.
Mames disease strikes again.
Oh, if mother could see me now. We've got it all to ourselves on that unforgettable half mile. Mean to say you were afraid, somebody might say. Very much so, chum. Hair standing up straight, eyes protruding like the white balls on chapel hat pigs. Show me the hero who stayed calm under his first shell fire and I'll show you a liar.
I like that quote. There's a lot of atmosphere in Dells. That's from the War Museum. It's a document there. Now, they're often left isolated, just in scrapes in the ground. There's nothing else. It's quite flat and open, the plain, in some places. Even on Kirchsteppe, you've just got to find what cover you can. And I'm going to be... Who am I going to be?
You're going to be Second Lieutenant Ivan Kirkpatrick of the 1st 5th Inniskilling Fusiliers.
There was no one in front of us, but the enemy of whose whereabouts or number we had no knowledge, and we must try to dig in, as the staff were of the opinion that we should be shelled in the morning. That night was one of the most arduous and uncomfortable I have ever spent. The soil was hard and rocky. Our only digging implements were entrenching tools. We dug all night and when dawn broke had little to show for our labours. Most of the men had succeeded in digging shallow graves, oh dear, with a parapet of loose earth and flints. But some who had struck rocks had not even that. He's over the left, he is over up towards Kirchsteppe.
Now, unsurprisingly, they're ravaged by a raging thirst.
Well, this is what we were talking about. It must have been murder. Can you imagine? What else might just put the bloody top hat on it?
Well, it's exacerbated by their physical efforts and the leeching effect of the cordite smoke.
Cordite is apparently, I don't know from personal experience, but it's very thirst-making.
Yeah, and that goes on for hour after hour. They're pinned down, unable to move. They're sweating in the sweltering sun with dust caked on their faces and their cracked dry lips are black with blood.
Oh, who painted pictures?
Controlling the men, it's almost impossible once they're out of earshot, as the communications available in 1915 just can't cope with it.
Well, what about wireless?
Wireless sets were far too heavy and unwieldy to be portable, and it's extremely difficult to run out and maintain telephone wires while runners were being sniped mercilessly.
So if you've got a runner, they'll tend to be shot as they try and get back. Now... So that is a disadvantage in command and control. I accept that, Gary. But I think that even with that severe handicap, they're just useless as senior officers. The brigadiers, the divisional commanders, Hammersley and Stopford. Why do you think? What, go through it with me. What is useless about them?
Well, a number of them were paralysed by fear of failure, and they're unwilling to take a chance. And that's the default setting.
Do nothing.
Yeah, do nothing. Absolutely. So attacks are being ordered and cancelled. Troops are being marched backwards and forwards to no constructive end.
This is the grand old Duke of York syndrome. Yep.
The sheer scale of the Suga operations and the relatively large distances involved tend to exaggerate the communication
problem. So it's worse than somewhere where you can walk across it. It's big. It's a big area, isn't it? The other thing, what's a weakness of medium command?
Well, they constantly seek to defer to the higher authority.
Oh, well, that's all right. What about? Who's the higher authority?
Yeah, let's have a think about this. So in this case, the higher authorities were Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Stopford, who's hampered by an injured knee.
He'd fallen and hurt his knee.
And he's hopelessly out of touch aboard the yacht Jonquil.
Now, I understand him being on the Jonquil because he's got a communications hub there, but he is out of touch. But he's not really in charge, is he?
No, ultimate authority is Hamilton, isn't it? And he's got his eyes firmly fixed on the Anzac breakout.
Because that's the main operation.
Yeah, and at this stage, he's paying little attention to Subaru.
This sounds like just a command vacuum. There is no one taking command and control of the situation. What about the more junior? Remember, you can't always just blame the. We give plenty of praise to the staff, but sometimes the staff aren't doing well. Why might the staff not be doing so well?
Well, the headquarters is hastily cobbled together and it's staffed by officers with little relevant experience. And it's not only the generals who don't know what they're doing. Almost no one knew what they were doing.
And this is the whole time. I mean, even on the British Army as a whole, there's a problem with staff officers. A lot of the trained past staff college before 1914 had gone to their units and been killed in 1914. So there's a real problem with the lack of experienced, competent staff officers who are young enough to withstand the pressure and the conditions. So all the long boiling afternoon of the 7th, who's controlling Chocolate Hill? That was going to be captured before dawn, then it was going to be captured just after dawn. Chocolate Hill, the Green Hill, the W Hills, who's controlling them? Have we got them?
No, they all remain firmly in Turkish hands, and it's not until the light was beginning to fail that elements...
So that's late,
That's late.
Now, using your expertise on August, that would be 9 o'clock, half 8?
Yeah, probably about half 8, I would have thought. And it's not until then that the 10th Division sort of join in, and it's just after 7 o'clock, Pete, I think.
Yeah, again, that's right. Sorry, I was just being childish there. And yes. It's only after that that the Chocolate and Green Hills are captured. What about W Hills? Is that captured? Or Scimitar Hills? Is that captured? No.
No.
And that's the point. We have got the foothills of the foothills. So after all of this, have we got the heights at the back, the Teke Tepe? Have we got Kirik Tepe? Yes or no, Gary? Answer the question.
No.
Oh.
Now, Lyman von Saunders, he reacts really quickly once he was sure that Belair would not be the focus of attack.
He always worries about Belair. That's a thing we had on the 25th of
April. He does, yeah. But he dispatches the 7th and 12th Division to Suvla at 07:20 on the 7th of August.
That's early, yeah.
Yeah, so on arrival, somewhere east of Teke Tepe, at about 2200 on the 7th of August, their commander asked for time for his exhausted men before launching a counterattack. And guess what happened?
He's sacked.
He's abruptly replaced by Mustafa Kemal, which has no real discernible impact.
It doesn't, because
the troops are indeed exhausted.
And they wouldn't actually launch a counterattack until the very early morning of the 9th of August. But I feel somewhat sorry for that commander who's sacked. But that treatment of people not pushing people forward is something British could have done with more of.
Yeah, and it's only that fatigue that gives the British another day to have any sort of chance of success.
Now, we're not going on to tell the further story because we'll deal with that in other podcasts at some later time. But we're talking about the landings. We have discussed it. They had not achieved their objectives. Was it really a feasible occupation? I mean, the Anzac breakout, we've decided, was completely hopeless from start to finish, really.
Well, it was unnecessarily complex, as often.
What, you mean the marching around the north of... Why? Why not across it?
Well, and then all the changes and everything, it became more complex and things were diluted. And let's not forget the vigorous Turkish reaction.
We should never forget that, because in the end, it's their vigorous and dynamic opposition that defeats us. And that, it's not just British mistakes, is it?
No. And you know, arguably, the British underestimated that. And surprisingly, given what had happened at the landings in April. So you've also got the inexperienced nature of the British troops and lack of any push
any
displayed
push
by
at
the
all.
Generals. They've got no drive.
Now, we just briefly go through. Was there any chance? Quick reorganisation the morning of the 8th August, and they try and take the foothills and they push along Kirik Tepe, take Scimitar Hills, the W Hills, Teke Tepe Ridge. If they'd done that, they could have done that. They could have done it on the 8th. But were they ready for it? Were they ready? No. Because what happens is Hammersley and his brigadiers, Hammersley commanding 11th Division, and his brigadiers, they're utterly broken men. They just allow the troops to rest and reorganise on the 8th. They don't push forward for the ridges. to summarize, so in the end, and then the campaign just goes on. It's a nightmare, and it's just assaults and defeats all the time. And we'll come back to it. I think, in summary, the Ninth Corps is thrown into battle long before they're ready, with incompetent commanders, their ludicrously optimistic plans, which presume token Turkish resistance, and the Turkish resistance is brilliant. What do you think of Major Wilmer? I think he's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very simple plan, but his original defensive positions had been well chosen. His men were well briefed, and they fought hard, Pete.
They did fight. They were better. They were better troops because they'd been trained better. They had more experience.
Yeah, and they'd withdraw at the last moment to the next defensible position. They didn't stand and die. You know, credit has to be given to the superior quality of the Turkish opposition, whose efforts are often unsung. And we've said it before. Good soldiers in defence.
Now, one thing that annoys me is the self-serving sort of analysis of Hamilton and his senior staff officers. Now, you're going to be one of his senior staff officers, Major Guy Dorney, at the headquarters of the MEF, which I find easier to say. And this is enough to make you want to punch him in the face.
Our plans all succeeded and worked out beyond expectations satisfactorily. But the task set to the new army divisions was, as it turned out, rather beyond their powers, owing to the fact that their officers were not sufficiently trained. It is no one's fault, but officers can't be made good company leaders, even after nearly a year. The result was that, though the new army divisions were not opposed by any great force, and though they had practically no artillery against them, they could not get on quickly enough, and their advance hung fire.
Have you heard of that sort of excuse-making in management before?
Hmm.
Blaming other people. Surely the quality of the materials you're sending to battle is part of making a plan.
Exactly, and he's got a vested interest in defending the integrity of that plan, hasn't he?
Now, what does Hamilton... Now, Hamilton, he's so clever and yet so stupid at times. His analysis is cutting. It's got some truth in it. But on the other hand, who's responsible for this situation? He is. Anyway, what does Hamilton say? It's a very witty epigram.
Just as no man putteth new wine into old bottles, so the combination between new troops and old generals seems to be proving unsuitable.
You know, so to his staff, to him, he's got nothing to say sorry about. Oh, I'm not sorry. But do you know what? I think even the most well-led and elite battalions would have had trouble carrying out the operational orders that those staff officers and Hamilton issue. Given the robust opposition of Major Wilmer and his Turks at Suvla, whose plan was it? In the end, whose plan is it? Who's always responsible? Whose plan is it?
It's Hamilton's. So he's responsible. But let's face it, he had plenty of scapegoats to screen his ultimate responsibility. And later, there was a cull of Ninth Corps senior officers.
Nearly all of them. But he remained. He remains for another 2 or 3 months. Well, the landings at Suvla, which we've covered, an absolute disaster. If you want to read more, I recommend my own book, Gallipoli, or the book I wrote with Nigel Steele, Defeat at Gallipoli. Both of them, in my view, lovely. You've read them both, haven't you, Gary?
I've read them both.
And you've learnt what?
Not necessarily at the same time.
Well, so there we go. The landings at Suvla, an utter disaster. And I look forward to being able to go and revisit the scene.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Gary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?